The advice given on this show is for informational purposes only. It is not intended as investment advice. Please consult a financial advisor before undertaking any investment decisions. While the show's producers have tried to provide accurate and timely information and have relied on sources they believe to be reliable, the show may include inadvertent technical or factual inaccuracies. Jack Monteith and Ken Smith do not warrant the accuracy or completeness of the materials provided and expressly disclaim any warranties or merchantability or fitness for a particular purpose.
Good morning and welcome to the Successful Investing Radio Show with me, Jack Monteith, and my business partner, Ken Smith. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning, Jack. Always a pleasure.
This is a show that is designed to help you build wealth, preserve your wealth, and to enjoy the fruits of your success. Ken and I have a combined 40 years of experience and are partners in the Empirical Wealth Management Investment Firm. Ken, as you know, our business utilizes the concept of values-based financial planning.
Yeah.
Which leads us to today's interview with Bill Bachrach.
Yeah. And I'll just share a little bit about Bill. Bill is one of the most recognized names in the financial services industry today. He was named one of the four most influential people in the financial services industry by Financial Planning Magazine as the father of values-based financial planning philosophy and the trusted advisor concept. Bill's work has had a profound impact on how financial professionals conduct business, and he has stood at the forefront of the movement to transform the financial services industry into a true profession. Bill is the author of four of the industry's most definitive works, including Values-Based Financial Planning, which is one of our favorites, Jack, and High Trust Leadership, and he has delivered well over 1,000 presentations worldwide. Before we get into our interview with Bill, I just want to give out our contact information at Empirical. You can reach us Monday through Friday, 8 to 5 p.m. at 1-800-923-4307. That's 1-800-923-4307. Our website address is empiricalwm.com, and Empirical is spelled empiricalwm.com. And if you want to listen to this show, other past shows, and see what's coming up, you can visit our radio website at successfulinvestingradio.com. Successful Investing Radio is all one word.
Great. Right.
Let's do it. Well, Bill, Jack and I want to thank you for coming on the show and Successful Investing Radio and being a part of it.
Well, Jack and Ken, it's my pleasure. I appreciate the invitation.
Great. Well, Bill, we've been truly inspired by the work you've done to help individuals and their advisors understand how financial values enhance planning. And we recommend your book, Values-Based Financial Planning, to our clients and our radio listeners. And would you mind sharing with us what inspired you to write this book and explain what values-based financial planning is?
Sure, Ken. I'd be happy to. Well, it all started for me in the mid-1980s when I was a financial advisor, and it was a combination of my professional experience as a financial advisor and also my study of personal development and success principles to learn how people live happy and successful lives. So I believe that money plays a role in success and happiness. Unfortunately, the predominant training in the financial services industry for teaching financial advisors how to get clients is sales training. And sales training tends to be focused on creating fear in people, then making features and benefits presentations about the products and services, handling objections, and then working to close the sale. So the common things that you and your listeners might have heard over the years from financial advisors are things like, you don't plan to fail, you fail to plan. What will happen to your family and your future if you don't save enough? What happens to your assets if you don't invest properly? If I could show you a way to get a higher return on your investments and pay less tax, you'd want to know about it, wouldn't you? And they ask these kind of questions, things like what happens to your family if you die prematurely, painting that beautiful picture of your daughter's turning tricks and your wife selling drugs and kind of that fear-mongering approach.
Right.
And in my day, in the early 80s when I first got into the business, the big fear was inflation. So we were just coming out of a very high inflationary period. Interest rates were very high. And so there was this fear-mongering about what happens if you don't keep up with inflation. It erodes your buying power, which means you can live long and run out of money. How would it make you feel to be a burden on your family or society? And I think we've all been on the wrong end of that kind of fear-mongering. And salespeople call it digging people into a hole and then throwing them a rope. So they ask questions or make statements to scare you, right. And then shockingly enough, their product or service is the rope to get you out of the hole they just dug you into. Does that sound familiar, Ken?
Yeah, it does, unfortunately.
It's not a very pleasant experience, but that is the predominant type of training that most of us were taught in the financial services industry. The other sales motivator, of course, is greed. You saw it during the internet and the tech boom of the late 90s, and it's rampant among financial advisors who either out-and-out promise or more subtly imply that if you work with them, you'll get a better return. It's that we can beat the market cheerleading, the ultimate salesperson's promise, a higher return but with the same or lower risk. And I don't know about you, but I'm not sure which is more amazing. The fact that financial product salespeople still use these tactics or the fact that people are still gullible enough to believe them. Maybe P.T. Barnum was right when he said there's a sucker born every minute. You may not be able to tell this from reading my books and my articles, but I'm not known for being especially diplomatic, so let me just say that I think these tactics suck, for lack of a better word.
All right. Well, we appreciate your candor there, Bill.
So to fully answer your question, when I was a young financial advisor, I too was learning and applying these sales tactics, and they do work. I was making money, but I wasn't happy with the proverbial man in the mirror, knowing that my approach to building my business was to make people feel like crap in order to get them to buy my products, or worse, to imply that I could achieve the impossible, which is to beat the market without taking more risk than most people are comfortable with. That being said, you do have to get clients if you're a financial advisor and building your business. So if you can't scare people into becoming clients or appeal to their greed, what do you do? And that was the dichotomy that led me to create values-based financial planning. The answer to the question of how to build a business without sales techniques is to actually do something that's valuable for people, that helps them make smart choices about their money. And the answer to do that is values-based financial planning. And there are plenty of financial advisors like you two who stepped outside of the normal financial services industry sales training and operate this way.
Right.
Many of you have done it on your own, and we've been training financial advisors to be trusted advisors, not salespeople, for just over 20 years now.
Bill, in your book, it seems to be a cornerstone of your concept is answering the question, what's important about money to you? And why is it important to understand that question? And what benefits will an investor derive from this exercise?
Well, Jack, in a word, it's crucial. This is the core question to help people explore their values. And you hear a lot of talk about values, and most of us have an intuitive sense of what's important to us. But to take that and put it on paper, side by side with your spouse's values, is a very powerful exercise from which you will almost immediately begin to make better choices. So not just better financial choices, frankly, but one of the things I've been telling financial advisors for over 20 years is don't be a financial advisor, be a life advisor who specializes in money. So our money choices have an effect on our life, and our values should not only drive our money choices, but really should drive all of our choices in life.
Now, Bill, also in the book, you recommend that the husband and wife go through this exercise separately. Why is that?
Primarily so that your answers aren't influenced by either spouse. So when I say separately, I don't mean that you have to be sequestered into separate rooms or some type of a soundproof booth. I simply mean that you are facilitated up your value staircase, and if you are, in your case, Jack, you'd go up the value staircase completely. And what's your wife's name?
Marlene.
Marlene. And then Marlene would be taken up the value staircase completely. And while you're talking about what's important to you, Marlene, hopefully, would be listening with interest to what's important to you. And if I were facilitating that conversation, then I would make sure that Marlene wasn't able to interrupt you or that she didn't inject her values or what she thinks they are. So it's much more powerful, not just for the person who is moving up the value staircase, but also for the spouse who's listening to hear what their spouse says is important to them.
So, Bill, how do you recommend that people perform this exercise?
Well, in the book Values-Based Financial Planning, there is a very good exercise with instructions that will help people get this done. And it was an effort. It was an effort to really put the exercise in a written form with clear instructions that people could follow. And we know from the tens of thousands of people, actually hundreds of thousands of people who own a copy of Values-Based Financial Planning, we know that it's doable by following the exercise. But really the best way is to have someone with experience facilitate the values conversation like I just described to Jack. If he and Marlene were, if I were doing this, I would sit each of them down and take each of them up the staircase. So the best way is somebody who has experience doing it to facilitate it, and the next best thing is to follow the instructions in the book.
Gotcha.
Bill, you make a big distinction between values and goals. Could you share with us what the difference between values and goals and why it is important to start with understanding your values first?
Sure, Jack. That's a very good point. Values, in a word or in a few words, are the emotional why behind the goals, and the goals are the tangible what. So values tend to be a little bit more esoteric, philosophical, conceptual, sometimes even a little ethereal, where goals are very tangible. So a goal, for example, a tangible goal is something like retirement or financial independence. You can put a number to a goal, you can put a target date to a goal, you can put some words that describe what a person is thinking and feeling once they achieve that goal. The values behind the goal might be things like having security and freedom and making a difference for my family and feeling a sense of satisfaction and purpose and fulfillment in life. So as you can see or you can hear from the words I'm using, the goals are very tangible. And the values are more the emotional why behind the goals. And the reason that you should start with the values is because your values put you in a better frame of mind to accurately define your goals. They help you think a little bit bigger picture about your whole life rather than being in the moment consumed maybe with today's problems. If you just put, if you just filled your gas tank and you're unhappy with what that cost you, and that is in the forefront of your mind, that's not necessarily the best mindset to be thinking in the big picture about what your long-term goals are.
Great.
Gotcha.
How often do you recommend an individual revisit the question, what's important to you about money?
Well, there are two ways to think about that. One is that it's a good idea to look at and review your values on a regular basis. I like to look at my values. I have these tools called a financial roadmap and a success roadmap, and I like to look at those at least once a week. It does a couple of things for me. It gets me focused on what's important, so I'm not so consumed with just the day-to-day problems and minutia, and that alters how I choose to spend my time, which has an effect on the quality of my life. It also helps inspire me. I don't know about you guys, but there are some days that are better than others. There are some days when I feel like doing the things that I need to do to have the life that I want, and there are days when I don't feel like it. And so it's easy to get motivated to do what needs to be done on the days when you do feel like it, a little harder on the days when you don't. So I find by reflecting on what's important to me and looking at my goals, it has an effect on how I choose to invest my time. So my day is better, which makes my week better, which makes my life better. The other, maybe what's implied in your question is, should the values be reevaluated or should you redo a values clarification exercise? And the answer is you rarely have to do that. For the most part, our values don't change. Our values have been ingrained in us for a very, very long time. So when you do a values clarification exercise or a value staircase on a financial roadmap, they just rarely change. What can happen is in a particular period of your life, one of your values may become accentuated. So, for example, if you're moving through your life, as most of us normally are, and somebody close to you or you have some kind of an illness or some kind of an event that brings focus on that particular value, you'll be focused on that value for that period of time. But once your life gets back to normal, for lack of a better word, then values tend to realign as they've always been. So redoing the exercise is something that rarely needs to be done, if ever.
Bill, this is Jack. I'll just finish with one small comment on that. You know, really, I just had an aha moment, because now I can see the great tool of using this and determining what your values are. You know, you said you revisit it on a weekly basis. I can see where you can kind of use that as a tool to kind of recenter, you know, your vision and what's important to you. So great answer. Thank you.
And Bill, I just want to follow up on that. We're talking about do values change, but you obviously, as the inventor of this, have done it a lot more than we have. And I'm curious, do you find that in a husband and wife situation or a couple, that they learn a lot about each other after they perform this exercise?
Ken, that is huge. And in fact, I didn't invent the idea that values have an effect on human behavior and that values drive our choices in life. What I did is I packaged it in a financial services format, because that's my background.
Gotcha.
But you really hit the nail on the head in my process of trying to figure this out, because in the mid-1980s, when I was, as I mentioned, unfortunately, initially a student of sales techniques, I realized that, boy, I really don't want to sell people things. I want to help them make good choices. So in my study of what helps people make good choices, there was a lot written about your values. And I experimented a lot. I thought, how do I bring this discussion about what's important to people into a discussion with a financial advisor, because they're not really used to that. Most of your listeners on this show probably think in terms of, well, you talk to your advisor about what's going on in the economy, or what's going to happen in the market, or what happens depending on who is the president, or which party is in Congress, and everybody's trying to second guess and beat the market. So when I started doing this in the mid-80s, it was odd. It was uncomfortable for me, and I think it was uncomfortable for some of my clients and prospective clients who I was experimenting with. But what motivated me to carry on and to continue to do it was exactly what you described. It was these huge bonding moments between spouses. It was sitting down with couples in their 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s and having them look at each other and say things like, wow. I mean, intuitively, they knew it was important to their husband or wife, but to have that wow moment and go, I've never heard you phrase it that way.
Right.
To be able to, I mean, I'm sitting here telling you the stories, having reflection. I'm getting goosebumps telling the stories. and I remember actually seeing them. You could see them physically. You could see the hair on their arms raise up as they got goose flesh. You could see their eyes well up with tears as they had these incredibly bonding experiences. From my point of view as a financial advisor, and I think this is valuable for you too as well as for your listeners, as it also told me a lot about the couple. Let's face it, half of marriages, unfortunately, end up in divorce. Money is a big issue. One of the things that I discovered from having values conversations with couples is it flushed out fairly quickly whether or not these two people actually get along.
Right.
And, you know, if a couple doesn't get along, if they don't have some commonality in their values, more importantly, if they don't respect each other's values. So my wife Ann and I don't have exactly the same values, but I like to think that we have a respect for each other's differences. So what you find sometimes when you have a values conversation, and those of you listening and who are going to invest in the book and try this at home, pay attention to, does your spouse try and manipulate your values? Is your spouse really interested in hearing what's important to you, or are they more interested in telling you what ought to be important to you, because that's what's important to them? So there have been some, you're right, I've done this thousands and thousands of times and trained thousands of advisors and heard the stories from them, and it's that most of the time a powerful, positive experience But when it's not, it's something to pay attention to.
Right, right. It's probably a good exercise before people get married to
It probably is, but yeah. You know, at the end of the day, I'm not a therapist.
Right.
I'm not a marriage counselor. I'm not qualified to do either of those things.
Yeah.
But if a couple doesn't get along and can't somehow figure out a way to make decisions in harmony, it will affect their ability to achieve their goals, and it'll affect their happiness.
Right. Well, I'm going to shift gears a little bit here, Bill. In your book, you mentioned that there are three types of people as it relates to professional help and how they choose to receive that or not. Would you share with us the three types and describe their characteristics?
Sure, Ken. I think you're referring to the do-it-yourselfer, the collaborator, and the delegator. Is that right?
Right. That's how you divided it.
So the term do-it-yourselfer is fairly self-explanatory. I once saw a TV commercial for do-it-yourselfer financial services firm that featured a man, and if you can visualize this, he's kicked back in his beach chair on the end of his dock, and there's a big yacht in the background. And he folds his hands behind his head, and he says, "Why would I pay someone else to do what I could do for myself?" And that's the mantra of the do-it-yourselfer. Do-it-yourselfers tend to value money over time, or they may have trust issues. You hear do-it-yourselfers say things like, "If you want something done right, you have to do it yourself."
Right.
Do-it-yourselfers also tend to get gratification from figuring things out and doing things themselves. If you're ever stranded on a desert island, you would want to be there with a long-time do-it-yourselfer. The delegator has exactly the opposite point of view. If the delegator was sitting on the end of that same dock, their mantra would be, "Why would I do anything myself that I could pay someone else to do?" So the delegator tends to value time over money. They like having experts tell them what to do, and if you're going to pay an expert to tell you what to do, then you might as well follow their advice.
Right.
I mean, what's the point of paying for advice if you're not going to follow it? So delegators seem to like the simplicity and the less time-consuming nature of paying for expert advice and following it. One of my favorite experiences, I've given a lot of speeches over the years to financial advisors, some to consumers, but more to financial advisors. And Peter Lynch, the famous manager of the Fidelity Magellan Fund, and I were both making presentations at a conference in the early 90s. I think it was 93, 94. And the audience of financial advisors was a little skeptical about Fidelity's intentions to create relationships with advisors when Fidelity had been so successful building a consumer direct business with no load mutual funds. And Peter Lynch was smart to address their concerns in the beginning of his speech. I'm paraphrasing a little bit here, but the essence of his remarks were that the Magellan Fund, to that point in time, had delivered a 16% average annual return. However, the typical investor in the Magellan Fund only achieved a 2% return. So how is that the case? How is it that the fund was delivering 16% a year and the investors in the fund were only getting 2% a year? Well, according to Peter Lynch, the majority of Magellan Fund investors were getting a poor return because they were trying to market time the fund by moving in and out and essentially making the classic mistake, buying high and selling low. He told the audience that Fidelity's research indicated that clients who have a good advisor don't play that game. Therefore, they actually get the return the fund delivers, in this case, a 14% positive swing. And that's why Fidelity wanted to work with advisors. He had their attention,
right.
And that's the benefit of being a financial delegator. So I think the delegator appreciates that the advisor may not be any smarter than he is, but the advisor is more objective and can help the client make very important decisions at crucial times when those decisions may be counterintuitive. And the third person that you asked about is the collaborator. And the collaborator is in between the delegator and the do-it-yourselfer. They don't have expertise to know everything they need to know to be their own financial advisor, but they struggle to really completely let it go and follow an advisor's advice. So the collaborator tends to have several advisors, maybe none of whom they especially trust, But they end up getting options from these different advisors. They do some of their own homework, and ultimately they make their own decision. And Ken and Jack, I don't believe there's an absolute right or wrong to being a do-it-yourselfer, a delegator, or a collaborator. I do personally have a bit of a bias toward delegation because I happen to be a person who values time over money. And the reason is because there's so many things in my life that can't be delegated that I want to do. So I look for areas where I can delegate, which frees up more time. There are only 168 hours in the week. Some of them are sleeping, some of them are eating, some of them are taking care of hygiene, showering, brushing your teeth. So with that limited amount of time, I tend to prefer to delegate. So it's an individual choice. I think every listener, everybody has to decide what works better for them.
Well, Ken, that about does it for this show. Time really flies.
Sure does.
So before we retire to the pool, why don't you tell our listeners about our upcoming guest and some contact information for us.
Sure. You can reach us at Empirical Monday through Friday at 1-800-923-4307. That's 1-800-923-4307 if you have any questions about the show or you're just interested in meeting us and looking at Empirical as an option to be your financial advisor. We encourage you to give us a call. You can visit our website at Empirical, EmpiricalWM.com. And to listen to this show, other past shows, and see what's coming, you can visit our radio website at SuccessfulInvestingRadio.com. And coming up in one of our shows, we're going to have Professor Robert Shiller, a multi-book author, and his recent book is The Subprime Solution, How Today's Global Financial Crisis Happened and What to Do About It. So that'll be an exciting show you want to tune in for.
Now that's a very timely topic. So until next week, have a great day.
Have a great week.
The advice given on this show is for informational purposes only. It is not intended as investment advice. Please consult a financial advisor before undertaking any investment decisions. While the show's producers have tried to provide accurate and timely information and have relied on sources they believe to be reliable, the show may include inadvertent technical or factual inaccuracies. Jack Monteith and Ken Smith do not warrant the accuracy or completeness of the materials provided and expressly disclaim any warranties or merchantability or fitness for a particular purpose.